Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Sober Indian Saturday Night Live. This is Karen. I'm your host, and tonight we have Wesley joining us. Hello, Wesley. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. We can start, because I know that you know you were on, it's been a little while since you've been on. We can pick up wherever you want to, and I will give the floor to you to talk.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Okay, my name's Wes, and I'm a recovering addict, alcoholic. You know, I'm also an adult child of an alcoholic, and I'm also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of AA, NA, and Well Variety. you know, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm from Oklahoma. I'm a member of the Pawnee Kickapoo Nations of Oklahoma. And so, and my mother was a full-blooded Kickapoo. My dad was a full-blooded Pawnee, and he used to run the Pawnee area when he left Pawnee as a young man, and he moved to McLeod, Oklahoma, around the Shawnee, Oklahoma area, and he never went back. And a little story how I came into the program. My first introduction to any 12-step program was through AA as a child. And I remember attending an AA meeting with my father, and I didn't know at the time that years later that I would be seeking help through Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is I was 7 or 8 years old, but I didn't realize what AA was about at the time. I had no idea what 12 steps programs was about, and as I look back, I knew my dad at the time was he was there for a reason. He was looking for help, and I understand a little bit better, because me being a recovering person and a recovering alcoholic and a drug addict, I have going through my own personal trials and issues, I have a pretty good understanding, you know, that what he was trying to accomplish. And you know, I lost my father to alcoholism at the age of 11 years old. I was off to church camp. And, you know, I came back from church camp and I found out that he had passed away and that he had passed away from alcoholism. And they found him, deceased in the middle of a hot summer day. And he was on Main Street, and evidently I don't know what all went on, but I really didn't know how to cope with that. I didn't know how to really process grief at the time. It was just another situation that I had to deal with. And I felt like throughout my childhood, there was a lot of instances like that. I never knew how to deal with grief or emotions at the time. And I carried a lot of that into adulthood. I carried a lot of that into recovery also. And, right now, you know, you guys caught me at a time when I'm dealing with a lot of that. I'm trying to understand the family dynamics of intergenerational trauma. I'm doing a lot of inventorying about my family and my past and what went on and why things were the way they were. And I have a lot of questions, you know, and so I'm trying to deal with that right now. I'm currently in therapy. I'm dealing with the PTSD, and that's what a lot of us natives, you know, not just natives, but it seems like others throughout the recovery community deal with a lot of trauma issues and. And so I'm trying to, sift through all this and trying to find healing through that and understand, some of the reasons why things happened the way they did. And so what I'm finding out is that there's a lot of trauma that happened in my family that goes back generations, a lot of unresolved issues and unresolved trauma that that is in my family tree. And so I have an 11-year-old daughter, and I want this to stop with me. I want this cycle of addiction to stop with me. And I often worry a lot about her. I'm a 60-year-old native male with 11-year-old daughter. And I worry about her well-being, her welfare. I worry about her mental health. And but one of the gifts of recovery has brought me is brought me to a to take responsibility, and that never would have happened, you know, in active addiction because I ran from responsibility. I guessed a lot what normal was. I didn't know what normal meant. I didn't know what it was to hold a job. I didn't know what it was to step up and take responsibility for anything. I was sitting in a meeting once, and someone spoke about when they didn't know what it was like to even go out and to buy a loaf of bread, and I related to that, you know. And I didn't know what it was like to even do simple things, you know. I had to guess what normal was, and so I tell people that I'm not a self-made person. That everything that I have in my life today, someone has taught me how to, you know, taught me. You know, they taught me how to be a responsible person throughout recovery. But first, I had to get sober. And nothing comes, you know, nothing's going to happen good in my life or anyone's life until they put that chemical down and stop self-medicating through the other, you know, through their addictions. And my first introduction was, you know, when I was 8 years old, and there's a lot of history there, you know, that I went through and with alcoholism. And I remember coming into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember having getting a sponsor, and he wrote me a letter, and he said, you know, Wes, this is what I do for my recovery. If you don't want to do these things, I'll still be your friend, but I'll just continue to sponsor. I mean, he wrote me a little list of things to do, and one of them was to, before I do anything in the morning, before I go to the restroom or anything, you know, just get on your knees and ask for help. And there were certain meetings that he wanted me to attend, and certain times that he wanted me to call him, and it went on down the list, you know. And he goes, and I want you to find a job. You know, I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's washing dishes. I don't care if it's, I don't care if it's a paper route. I want you to have a JOB, and I want you to have a paycheck coming in. And the big one that really got me, you know, is because at the time I was very, very dependent on my mother, and I was living with my mother's house, and she would always pull me, out of tight spots. And when I needed a place to stay, she always provided that, you know, to a point that it was not, that it really wasn't good for me or her. And I remember down at the bottom of the list, he goes, and second of all, you know, I'm going to give you 90 days. And after 90 days, I want you to move out of your mom's house. And that really scared the hell out of me because I didn't know what it was to be responsible. I didn't know what it was to take care of myself. I didn't, let alone, you know, the job part. You know, I didn't know what it was to even hold a job, you know, because all my life I was, you know, dependent on someone else. I was dependent on her to a fault. And, my whole life was always centered around drugs in some form or another, whether it would be drinking alcohol or some sort of substance, you know, anything that would alter my reality in a way that would take away the way I was feeling. And I couldn't identify the way I was feeling, you know, through my addiction. All I knew was I was in a lot of pain, and I really couldn't, I didn't have the vocabulary to put things together or even express what was going on inside of me. I felt a lot of mixed emotions, a lot of mixed feelings. I had a lot of questions, and I had a lot of anger, outward anger, and that's what my addiction does, you know, did to me. It takes away the way I feel about me, the way I feel about you, and the way I feel about this world. And I felt alone a lot. I felt different. I was incorrigible. That's before I even took my first drink of alcohol. I was affected by it as a kid. You know, my father was this drunk that really that didn't show a whole lot of emotion when he was sober. You know, and I very much wanted, you know, to him to show some, you know, just to pay attention to me in some form or fashion. But when he was drinking, you know, things changed. You know, he would tell me how much he loved me and cared for me, you know, and I got all the hugs, but it was totally different when he was sober. And so that gave me a lot of mixed up feelings. You know, I didn't know quite what to think about that for years. You know, and like I said, there's just a lot of things that didn't make sense to me. So today, you know, I'm trying to decipher all that through some personal work and going back and looking at our family tree to why things were, and so I'm going through a period of time of, you know, I'm reflecting a lot about what happened and why the things were, why the things turned out the way they did, because, you know, recovery has given me a lot, but there's some issues that was unresolved in my personal life that was giving me some problems, you know, that I found myself having a hard time again, and so I'm going back and trying to address that through therapy and working the steps of the program. And so I growing up as a kid, I had all these mixed emotions, and you know, and I was really susceptible to just any, you know, I just wanted to be a part of something. I just wanted to be accepted in some form or fashion. So naturally, you know, like a lot of other, you know, other kids that just raised up in addiction, you know, I gravitated towards people who were like me, that were incorrigible, and you know, I just never really felt like I fit in, you know. Even though I was in school, I wasn't interested in school. I didn't like school. I felt different, and you know, I skipped school a lot. I hid out, and then I'd go home after school. You know, when school was over, I'd go home, and you know, and I ran into a lot of problems there. A lot of problems in school. They didn't know what to do with me, and things are a lot different today, you know, with kids, you know. You know, growing up, but this was back in the 70s, you know, they didn't know what to do with me. And back then in the state of Oklahoma, they had these reform schools. There was about four or five reform schools, and I was always getting threatened to get sent off to one of these schools for my behavior, for not going to school. And that's what they would do with kids. They didn't know what to do with us. And we didn't have a lot of help that we have today, you know, through mental health. And so I was getting threatened to get sent off to one of these schools. You know, you're going to end up in one of these places. You're going to end up in, and one of them was Pryor, one of them was Helena, one of them was Bowie, Oklahoma, and a few others, you know. But consequences never ever stopped me. You know, and that's the thing about I've learned about my own addiction, that consequences never got me clean and sober. You know, I did it anyway, you know. And so, you know, as a kid, you know, my family was, there's a lot of chaos in the family growing up. And I'm not knocking my family. You know, my mother and my family, they did, you know, do the best they could with what they had. And, you know, and so I want to say that right off, you know, this is not about blame. This is not about anything like that, you know, but there was just a lot of needs that weren't met, you know, and even today, you know, as I go back and study my family history, you know, how this trauma gets generational. you know, they're only getting, you know, probably they experience the same thing as I did, you know, and that's why it gets passed down from generation to generation. And they can't give away something they don't have or didn't receive themselves. And so that right there, right now, it's this bad situation that I'm trying to look at and see for what it is, because I carried all this pain around inside of me, even though I'm sober, a bit sober, you know, it's just like I carry a big weight on my chest, and, you know, I lug it around everywhere, and I couldn't figure out, you know, I'm sober now, you know, I got my own place, I got a place, I'm raising a beautiful daughter, I raised a son, and I got this place, and all of it, you know, I got a car that takes me from A to B, you know, and I get told that, you know, all the time, you have so much to be grateful for. You know what I do, you know, but I still carry this pain around, you know, and I just can't seem to shake it at times. And, you know, there's a few times where I've had panic attacks. I woke up and, you know, I was trying to take a nap and I woke up in a full-blown panic attack and I ran towards the door. I couldn't breathe and, you know, I felt like I was having a heart attack and, you know, so those are some of the questions that I'm trying to get answers and get healing towards, you know. So back several years ago, I was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And, I was even offered, you know, the first thing they do, you know, is they want to prescribe something for you, self-medicate. And, you know, I'm not totally against that, but for me, you know, it was just another way for me to kind of zone out, you know, and block out the painful feelings. And I knew I've had enough recovery behind me to know that if I was going to ever heal from that, this trauma, I've had to confront it, and I've had to deal with it, and so I can start letting it go. So that's what really I'm dealing with today. But it was a lot of that, you know, just as a kid, you know. It was just a lot of that from one day to the next. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, there was a lot of physical, mental abuse in the house. I've seen things that no child should see growing up, an eight-year-old kid, a lot of physical violence, a lot of screaming and hollering. And it's just terrifying, you know. And there was times I'd wake up in the back seat of a car at a bar. And, you know, just one particular instance, I woke up in the back seat of a car and my dad was tapping on the window and, you know, he brought me out a pop, you know, and a bag of chips, and he gave it to me and he went back into the bar. And there was times I'd wake up at someone's house in a back seat and he'd be in here, you know, with some female doing what he did, and I'd be outside and it'd be way out in the middle of nowhere. I didn't know where we were. And my mother always made me go with my dad. She was so angry at my father, you know, for not taking responsibility. So I was forced to go with my dad a lot, but my dad drank a lot. And so I did, you know, me and my other sister, I'm the youngest of the family, we didn't end up going with my dad. And, you know, so we didn't know where we'd end up. And I remember screaming, hollering, kicking. Not wanting to, you know, to go with my father. I wanted to stay with my mother. And so I got, you know, later, years later, I got angry. I mean, there was a lot of anger came out about that, you know, and I'll get into that a little bit later on, but there was a lot of anger. And because I felt abandoned and I felt neglected, you know. These days, you know, that would be really neglect, you know, the way things are today with dealing with the DHS, you know, that would have been abandonment, you know, at its highest order, neglect. And I probably would have been taken out of the home and put in some foster care. But, you know, those days, you know, they always ended up back with my parents, you know, but I love my parents. I was always so glad when they were together and they talked and, you know, we'd go on family outings and stuff like that, you know, but I got in that mode of wondering when the next shoe was going to drop, you know, things were good one day, and the next things can go to hell in a handbasket. And so that's why I'm so partial towards my daughter today. You know, I'm raising her. I'm a single parent, and I look at her, you know, and I want to be there for her. I want to be there emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. And she doesn't know what went on, you know. She doesn't know all this stuff. You know, and so I want it to stop with me. I want it to stop in this cycle. I want it to stop with me, and I want to be there for her. But, you know, I get emotional sometimes, you know, when I look at her, and you know, I'm trying to help her with a project or her school or something, you know, and I'm trying to nurture her and do the things I didn't get when I was growing up. And like I said, you know, they did the best they could with what you had. My mother was a good mother, and I learned some good quality things from her. And I also learned some things with my dad, you know, but he just wasn't with me. He died when I was 11 years old. And so my mom ended up raising five kids on her own. And that was really hard. There was times that we had to, she had to leave us. And she was a nurse's age. We had to go to work at night. She worked at the graveyard shift. And so we was left at home a lot by ourselves. And so, you know, and I loved her for that today, you know. I loved her for that. She passed away 3 years ago. And I was able to tell her goodbye. And I was able to, you know, kiss her and crawl up on a bed with her and tell her I loved her and tell her that, you know, and make amends to her also for all of the hell that I put her through. Because, you know, I wasn't an angel or anything like that, by no means. I did a lot of damage myself. You know, I just became a carbon copy of what I grew up in and what my father did. You know, I became everything that I didn't want to be. You know, I mean, I knew no other way to live. You know, it was just the culture I was raised up with. And, you know, when I talk about culture, I'm not talking about the feathers or anything like that. I'm talking about the culture that was around me. I mean, the only life that I ever knew. And I became, you know, a lot of the same way that he did, you know. But I learned at an early age to start self-medicating, you know, that if I took a substance into my body, it would take away the pain. And that's, you know, and I didn't know I was hurting that bad. You know, I look back now, you know, I just wanted to escape. It was just a way for me to escape, you know, the life that I was growing up in. And like I said, I never really, I felt like I fit in anyway. So I gravitated towards others that were just like me. And, you know, we kind of a group of us that I hung around with, and that's where it was for a lot of years. And so I got into an inhalants. I got into sniffing spray paint. I end up down the railroad tracks. I start blacking out on this spray paint stuff, and I'd get this all over me. I mean, it's gold spray paint, gold and silver spray paint. You know, I'd get it on my teeth. I'd get it in my hair. I'd get it on my jacket. My mother would buy me new clothes, and I'd go out, and I would just get it everywhere. But there was times that I would literally black out, you know, on this inhalants. I didn't know what I did. So I started blacking out at an early age, you know, and my first introduction even to any type of mind-altering chemical was sniffing gasoline. I got introduced to sniffing gasoline, graduated to sniffing spray paint. I was doing that a lot of years. I'd go through cravings for it. It got to where the Shawnee Police Department, they got to know us who we were, and so when they would see us, just one particular police officer, he knew who I was and got to know us. So he got to stopping us every time he seen us, and he would say, "Flop out your hands," and he would check our hands, and to, you know, if we had any type of markings on us from this spray paint, he would take us in. And he would take us to juvenile hall. As we got older, he would take us to jail. And no matter if we were, you know, intoxicated or not. And so I had a lot of friends that were just like me, and I also had a lot of cousins that were drinking wine. They were winos, and they were drinking whether it was Night Train Express, White Port Wine. They didn't like the Boone Swarm stuff or anything like that. It was either it had to be Mad Dog 2020, Boone Swarm, they thought it was like soda pop, but they would drink the stuff that would probably go straight to your liver. But you know, they would lecture me on this spray paint incident on huffing the spray paint, and they said, you know, why don't you hang out with us? If you hang out with us, though, you got to get off that, and you got to start drinking this. And they stuck a wine bottle in my face, and so I started drinking wine. But all I did, you know, as I look back on all I did, you know, because being an addict, you know, I mean, an addict is an addict to me. It doesn't matter if you're on Skid Row or if you stick a needle in your arm or if you stick a wine bottle, you know, pick a wine bottle up. You know, an alcoholic's an addict. All I did was switch addictions. And I got off the inhalants and drinking wine chronically, probably from the first point I ever did that. And that went on for several years, and I graduated from drinking wine to drinking vodka and wine. And I remember, you know, the wine wouldn't quite be strong enough, so I'd get a bottle of vodka and I'd pour it into wine and I would shake it up, you know, drink it out away. And before long, I was blacking out on that. And so, once again, I was blacking out and doing things, you know, that, you know, I couldn't even remember, you know, and doing things that I wouldn't do sober, you know, waking up in strange places, waking up in back seats of cars, and this time drunk. You know, it's not like when I was a kid waking up in the back seat of a car at a bar, but it just happened with me. I'd pass out, and I was doing a lot of crazy things and things I just totally wouldn't remember. And at this time, there was a lot, also a lot of, you know, the thing about addiction that, you know, it's a killer at the same time, because I had all these people passing away around me. They would find them dead everywhere, passed away from their alcoholism, or whether it be car wrecks, heart attacks, Ironman Fields, you know, but I kept doing this. You know, I just, like I said, it was the only thing I knew how to do. And from that point, it went on from just trying to block out the pain to oblivion. I would just drink myself into oblivion. And it got to where that I would do anything to get it, you know. And my mom, she had bought a new house. Gave her a new house, and I remember she had all this nice furniture in the house and the nice appliances, and I remember just pawning everything in the house that was in sight. And just all the stuff that she accumulated, I would pawn, and today that would be called, that's a form of elder abuse, and I did that in my adulthood too, you know. It was hard to deal with, you know, after I got sober, to look back on that, but I started at the time, you know, I was ended up in jail all the time. They got to stopping me once again. And most of the time I was drunk by then. They throw me in a drunk tank, and that seems like the only way I'd get sober. And I remember my mother telling me once, you know, she was always so glad when I got in jail, because at least she knew I was alive. You know, at least she knew I was alive. And I remember her telling me that, you know, she'd be so scared because I wouldn't come home for days. She didn't know where I was. She didn't know if I was dead or alive. And she already lost one husband to alcoholism, and she's afraid I was going to be next. I just couldn't put it down. And I was just low bottom drunk, you know, and that couldn't stop what he was doing. And so, it got to the point where it wasn't, I don't know if it was ever working, but it just got to the point where my body couldn't take it anymore, and I was sick all the time. And so I was in jail once, and someone came around, this outreach worker from the tribe, and he was an alcoholic counselor, and asked me if he can get me to treatment, if I'd be willing to go into treatment. And so anything's better than jail, right? So I agreed to that, and so he asked the judge, when I went to court, if I can go into treatment, and the judge said, agreed to it, so I went off to treatment. I went, and the thing about it is, the longest I've ever been sober was in jail or in that treatment, when I went to treatment for 90 days, and I got to feeling good. I learned a lot of things in there. I learned a lot about alcoholism and how it broke down in the body, what it did to your brain, a lot of educational, watched a lot of educational films. I went through a lot of educational classes, group therapy. And but the day I got out of treatment, I went back to the same thing that was doing before, back to drinking again. And over the course of several more years, I was in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment, in and out of jail. I counted one at one time. I was in treatment seven different times, not including halfway houses, jails. And it got to this point that these places started turning me down. It's like, here comes old Wesley. We tried to help him before, but he every time we try to help him, he falls off. He doesn't take it seriously. He falls off the wagon and he goes back to what he's doing. And so, this one treatment center, this one halfway house took a chance on me. And, I remember the counselor saying, Wes, we're going to help you, but if we feel like you're not taking us seriously, we're going to discharge you. And I didn't like to be told what to do anyway. I lasted less than 24 hours and I left. And that's, I went back once again, I went back to what I was doing. The only thing I had to do was drinking. And by this time, things were getting a little bit worse. I was getting sicker and sicker, drinking more. And the last time that I drank, I was on about a 10-day binge. And in those 10 days, I must have had a few bologna sandwiches. But it got to the point my body was so toxic that I just couldn't take it anymore. My body just couldn't take it anymore. And I was real scared, and I didn't know what to do. I was coming down pretty hard. And I remember this guy that I used to drink with. And the reason why I remember that, remember him, and I ended up on his front porch. And the way I remember him is that, I stumbled into an AA meeting at one time. I stumbled to an AA meeting, and I remember seeing him in this meeting, and he approached me. And I didn't recognize him at the time, who he was, because, when I was drinking with him, he had this long beard, long hair, I didn't recognize him because he had his beard trimmed and he had his hair trimmed and it was cut shorter. And I remember walking up to me and said, my name is such and such. We used to hang out together. We used to drink wine together. And I said, oh, yeah, man, you're looking good, But I ended up on this guy's doorstep. I remember where he lived, and I ended up on his doorstep. And I remember I asked him, I said, hey, man, do you still go to those meetings? And he goes, yeah, man. You want to go? I said, man, I need some help. I'm real sick. I need some help. And I said, can you give me a ride to ride home? And so I remember him taking me to my mom's, back to my mom's house once again. He took me to my mom's house, and I remember him let me off there. My mom came outside and he said, you know, this is Wes and I'm going to pick him up and take him to a meeting tomorrow, but I can't get this guy sober. I can't keep him sober. But what I can do is take him to meetings. I can pick him up and take him to meetings. And that's what he did. And I was coming down pretty hard. You know, I was DTing at the time, you know, and I should have been in some detox center. I probably even should have been somewhere coming down, somewhere in treatment, some medical attention, but something inside of me, you know, I guess, you know, we have that moment of clarity, something inside of me just kind of clicked and I had to know if I wanted this thing or not. And so I went and hit, and I was coming down pretty hard, and I was the only one in the house. My mother had went somewhere for a while, so I was left there alone, and I couldn't sleep. You know, I'd wake up, and I'd hear voices. I'd hear somebody call my name, and I'd say, what? And my chest was hurting. I felt like I was going to – my heart was going to pop out of my chest. I felt like I was having a heart attack. I was really scared, shaky. And the blinds were pulled down. I'd peep out the blinds. And, you know, I'd stay up all night, sleep to the well during the day. And this guy would pick me up every single day. He would take me to a meeting. He would take me to, and at the time, there was three meetings a day. He would take me to a noon meeting, evening meeting. And there was another meeting at 8 o'clock he would take me to. And that's the way it was for the first 30 days, take me to meetings. And I began to detox and I began to come down and I began to stay sober on my, you know, I'm not going to say on my own, but I began to stay sober with that treatment center of being in jail. I began to stay sober by going to meetings and hanging around other recovery people who were just like me. And so I had that moment of clarity, and I began to stay sober. And I stayed sober for 19 years.
And oh, wow.
I stayed sober for 19 years. And and I got into service work. I got into, you know, to doing a lot of going into prisons, carrying the message of recovery to prisons. And see, I focused on what they call a bridge to gap. I started going to bridge to gap meetings. Then I got into Narcotics Anonymous. So I started sitting on their boards and their committees. I switched from Alcoholics Anonymous to Narcotics Anonymous because it addressed some of my needs. At the time, you know, there was no crosstalk to other substances. They had to write this little blue card that says, you know, if you have alcohol problem, you're welcome to a tennis meeting, but you're not allowed to. A lot of the hardliners at the time were, they frowned on you talking about your addiction or, you know, any substance other than alcoholism. So I started going to Narcotics Anonymous. I felt like it fitted me better because it addressed all my addictions. And they looked at alcohol as a drug. So I found another home that I felt a little bit more comfortable in, where I could express myself a little bit better. And I stayed there. And I stayed clean and sober for 19 years. And I began to work with a sponsor. I began to achieve a little peace of mind. I started learning how to do the things I never thought how to, I never dreamed I would do, like hold a job down. Because you know, when I was growing up, I dropped out of school. I never finished high school. I didn't like school. Like I said, I didn't finish anything. Never finished the project. But here I was actually doing things I never thought I could do. And I had a lot of help doing it, you know. I mean, I had to be taught how to hold a job down. So I began to hold these jobs down, show up on time, go to work. I had to be taught how to do those things. And learn how to go into grocery store, buy a loaf of bread. And I had all these visible signs of success. You know, about the first 5 years, I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't know what it was. I didn't have a driver. I got pulled over, went to jail at 5 years in recovery. for not having a driver's license. I was sober, but I was still doing some of the same things that I was doing out there, you know, that I was just sober. The only thing that changed was that I wasn't doing was not drinking. And really wasn't working the steps or anything, but, I wouldn't, you know, but someone finally got a sponsor after my first year, and he said, you know, we got to get legal. And you got to learn how to be a productive member of society. So I got my driver's license at age 31 years old. First time I ever had a driver's license. And, man, that was an accomplishment to me because, man, you know. But, you know, a lot of normal kids, or normies, I call them, you know, but they get their license. They already went through driving school and got their license at 16 years old. You know, here I am 31 years old getting my license. But that was a big accomplishment for me. And that was a direct result of being sober in recovery. And I got that. And I remember I got this bomb of a car. You know, it was an Indian, real Indian car. You know, it looked like a big Batmobile. It was like a big Riviera. Well, that was my second car. The first car was an old Ford car. And it really was a one-eyed Ford car because, you know, I remember my son that was raised at the time, you know, sometimes I get pulled over for the headlight being out. And if you kick on it, you stick on a headlight, it would come back on. I'm getting pulled over because I didn't have a headlight. And I had all the, you know, driver's license by then, the insurance. And he goes, you know what, the reason why I pulled you over? And he goes, you know, your front headlight's out. And when my son getting in a car, you know, he kind of comically went around, he kicked the headlight, and it came back on, you know, and the police officer, he laughed about that. He goes, you need to get that fixed. You know, so it's kind of comical, but that was my first two cars, you know, and the second car, this big old Batmobile, looked like a big old pimp car. All the thing I was lacking was the pimp hat. You know, I needed to drive that around. But it was my car, you know, it was my car. I got a lot of kicks out of that, a lot of laughs, you know, about that, you know, but it was the smoothest car. You know, it felt like a boat, you know, when I drive it. It was really smooth running, you know. But it was mine, and got me from A to B. And you know, I graduated from that. I got newer cars, one of my first jobs was being a busser, and I went from busser to being a dishwasher. And then from a dishwasher, I went up to being a prep cook. And from a prep cook, I went up to being a line cook. From line cook, I went up to being supervisor over other cooks, being a head trainer. And from a head trainer, I went to being the director of a long-term care facility, being the chef there. And I ended up going to becoming a chef. And this is a result of recovery. And I'm doing things way beyond my education. You know, this is a guy that never completed anything. This is a guy that never completed high school. And so I was doing things that it was way beyond my educational level. Working with computers. I didn't know how to work a computer. I learned how to work in computers on a job training. And someone taught me and how to order things. And you click on this, you click on that, you need help. So, when I tell people I'm not a self-made person, everything that I have today has been taught to me through a loving God, through other people in recovery. So I had all these visual signs of success, you know, and things were going good, you know, and I felt like I was in the spring season of my recovery again. And even my lack of education, and, you know, I learned to put a label on it. You know, I was dyslexic, and back then they called it special education or learning disabilities, and they really didn't know what to deal with me. But it wasn't the fact that I was stupid; it was the fact that because of the environment that I grew up in, that even a lot of these today growing up, you know, the first thing they want to do is they want to self-medicate. They want to medicate our kids or our families, and they want to stick Ritalin in them or something in them, or Tegretol, or remember my, they wanted to stick Tegretol, my son on Tegretol, because there's emotional outburst. And but I went through the same thing, you know. I mean, I went through all the emotional outbursts in school. And, you know, it just, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not going to say, because some people really need it, but, you know, being an addict, our bodies, that's my belief, our bodies don't know the difference between prescribed or not prescribed. A lot of times it does more harm than good. And you know, all my life I wanted to escape reality. I didn't want to deal with life on life's terms. But I had all these visualized of success. And at 19 years old, 19 years, you know, I mean, I was doing pretty well, you know. But I'd work long hours, you know. And you're in the food industry. So, you know, it wasn't uncommon for me to get at work. And we'd do a lot of catering. I'd get to work at 4 in the morning, especially during the holiday season. That was our peak season. I'd get to, you know, it wasn't uncommon for me to get there at 4 o'clock in the morning and get off at midnight.
Right.
And the catering. And I was making good money, but I was doing long hours. And that's how I made my money. And that became my primary focus, you know, because that's really it made me, I thought, to who I was. It became my identity. It became, you know, all my self-esteem was wrapped up in how much money I could make, what I was doing, the titles that I held. And, you know, things began to slide. The meetings began to slide. I lost contact with my recovery community, my support system, my connections. And I stopped going to meetings. I end up in a meeting once in a while, maybe once a week. And in the end, it got to the point where I wouldn't go at all. And I lived in a college town at the time in Norman, Oklahoma. It's in Augusta University of Oklahoma there. And, you know, we'd get off and we'd be tired, and you know, but it's being a college town. It's also means it's a party town. And a lot of the workers that worked in the restaurant I did were college students, you know, and everybody was going out to clubs. And I remember getting invited to a club, and I would always say, no, I'm going home. So I'd go home, and most of the time I'd go home, you know. And but one night I got invited to a club, and so I went, and I sat there, you know, and everybody was dancing and the music was glaring, and you know, someone offered me a drink and I turned it down. I sat there and I drank a Coke. And but needless to say, few other times I started going back to these clubs and not drinking, but you know, there came a time, you know, when you know, if you can lose what you have if you don't keep watering, if you don't keep nurturing, you know, your recovery, you know, you can lose it, you know. I mean, you can forget where you came from. I thought that, you know, I had arrived at a place that I could, you know, but I remember ordering a beer and that insanity of the first drink, it came back. And I remember I just blocked everything out. I opened one beer at 19 years. I downed it, and I drank it. And I relapsed at 19 years. And so that started a 14-year relapse. And it set up a whole different chain of events, you know, that get into other addictions I never knew existed. I never even knew I had. Like I said, you know, when I identify myself more as an addict because I know that I can be addicted to anything that makes me feel good. I know that I can switch addictions real quick. You know, I've done it, you know. And so when I say I'm a recovering addict, man, that means from everything that I use to escape reality. You know, and I begin to, this is the time that the tribal casinos begin to come into view. And I remember hanging around at these casinos, and after work, I'd go to work. At this time, you know, I started drinking, but I told myself, I'm going to get off the hard liquor, and I'm just going to drink beer. Yeah, because when I drink beer, I don't black out on beer. I know my surroundings. I know when to stop. I'll get a little tipsy or grunt, but I know, you know, when to stop and know not to, when to drive, and, you know, rationalization, I can handle that. So, you know, and I guess, you know, I guess I, all I was a functional drunk, you know, just, and I started hanging around these casinos, and and they'd have these beer specials, and they, you know, I mean, dollar beer. I'd start drinking a dollar beer, playing the slots. A few times that I passed out at the slot machine, and I'd be sitting there, and the security would nudge me, and I'd just be sitting there, and you know, at the machine, and I'd kind of snap out of it, and I'd cash out and go home. But, you know, I became a gambling drunk, and I got to where I was spending my whole paychecks up in these casinos, hanging out there, so it was just another addiction I was doing. And I started to hang out there more and more. I started getting into loans, borrowing money, pawning my stuff, pawning everything, anything that was of value. And it was just a whole totally different area of somewhere I haven't been in my addiction. Still holding a job, mind you. Still holding a job. And it's been on for 19 years. And got married in between then. She ended up divorcing me because of my drinking again and my gambling. I'd gamble all the rent money away and all that. And, you know, and I would just, I felt really bad about what I was doing, but I couldn't stop. You know, I couldn't stop. I there were times I'd get paid and I wouldn't make it home. And I'd go into a casino and I would sit at the slots and she'd come find me. Sometimes I would have money and sometimes I wouldn't. And she stayed with me as long as she could, and she divorced me. And she took my little daughter with her. And that really hurt bad. And fast forward a little bit, I came back in recovery in 2017. And I was really ashamed. My pride almost kept me away. It kept me out. And it almost killed me because, you know, I was so embarrassed and so ashamed of what I did. Because, you know, here me, you know, Mr. Rah-Rah Recovery, you know, I remember telling people how to get sober. I sponsored people, and I sit on these committees, and I would tell people how to get sober. And it felt like I pissed all that away. And I came back in recovery, and I thought they were going to give me that Al-Anon handshake, you know, really stick the finger in my face, and you know, where you been? This is what happens when you relapse. But, you know, that's my warped thinking, my distorted my mind, you know, it's the way my brain texts me. Because every time I get, you know, get my mind up in my head, I mug myself. And so I went to this AA meeting. I called a friend of mine up that I was in recovery previous, and they said, there's a meeting tonight. Why don't you come down? Yada, yada, yada. I said, okay. I went down there and drove right out of block a couple of times. You live in there? And they were glad to see me. And they hugged. It wasn't like I thought it would be. They hugged me, and they was glad to see me. Two friends of mine that I knew previous that were in recovery that were still sober sat on each side of me. They gave me a meeting list, and they were glad to see me. And that was God doing for me what I, you know, God the Creator doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, even for other people. And I've been coming back ever since. Things have changed, you know. I started getting to. I was introduced several years ago to White Bison, Well Variety, and it introduced a whole new area that I felt like it was missing in my life. I was always around culture, but I wasn't, you know. I mean, they talk about the circle being the sacred circle, the circle being the power. You know, being a healing circle, but I was disrespected that circle because I was always around culture, but I was never in it. I was always in the background doing something I wasn't supposed to do and disrespecting that circle. So I got introduced to Well Variety several years ago, about 4 years ago. And I remember wandering to Well Variety. I lived in Oregon at the time. I wandered into a Well Variety meeting and one time before, but and I came back, and they introduced me to the steps through the culture. And it was just a missing link. I felt it was missing in my life. Here were recovering natives like myself coming together who was staying sober through not only the steps, but through culture, you know, cultural-based steps. And it was felt like a homecoming. I felt complete, like something that was missing in my life. So I started attending Wabrati, and that became my primary focus. That became my my homecoming too, and I still go to outside meetings. You know, I still go to AA. I go to NA meetings. You know, but my heart is really in Wabrati, the Wabrati movement. And back in December, I became a fire starter for Wabrati. And once again, that's created one for me because this last time around was a little different for me. You know, I really wanted to be of service to other. I was hurting at the time, but I remember this prayer, like a lot of us have, and it wasn't one of these, you know, those prayers we get, you know, when we're getting a tight spot, you know, you get me out of this tight spot, and I'll do this. But I really it was really heartfelt, you know, if you help me, then I'll give back and teach others what I know. And an agreement I made, you know, with the unseen world, you know, with the God, you know, creator of my understanding, you know, and he's been holding me to it, you know, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, like speaking, you know, I never consider myself a speaker, man. It makes me nervous, you know, I shake, you know, I don't know how well I'm going to do. And, you know, my strong points has always been working with others one-on-one. But I remember that promise I made, you know, that promise, you know, I'll help others. And so, but I don't know, I got a few more minutes, but I'm going to try to cram this into about 3 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes. But I remember, and I've been hearing this a lot, I hear this, you know, as I attend the meetings, that you can't give something away you don't have. I can't give something away in my life that I don't have. If I'm not healed in certain areas of my life, I can't tell you how to heal in your life. I can't help others. So I stepped back from this last week, I made a decision to step back from some things, but it's because I need to focus on some things, parts of my life right now that are unhealed in order to help other people, more or less. Yeah, I got to work on those unhealed parts of me that are hurting in order to help someone else. I'm going through that season of my life right now that I'm hurting a lot, and I feel that anguish a lot. But I know the steps are like a wound. It's like an infection, and that's the way I look at it, you know. And sure, I'm sober, and that's great, you know. But if I'm going to stay sober, if I'm going to have that emotional recovery, then I got to still start dealing with that infection. That means I got to dig in there, and I got to clean it out, and I got to start taking care of it, because, you know, like when someone once told me, man, if I don't take care of that wound, it's going to start to ooze. It's going to start to bleed again, you know. I'm going to bump up against something, it's going to bleed. It's not only going to bleed on me, it's going to start bleeding on everyone around me. And I don't want that to happen. So, you know, it's just time for me to start dealing with these. And I've been dealing with this for a while, you know, but I decided to step back from social media for a little bit. Not forever, because I'm on some recovery sites that I'm a part of, but just to deal with focus on these issues and get focused on what I need to do to address the unhealed parts of me, the trauma, and to look at this intergenerational trauma. So I won't have to bleed all over myself and other people around me. And I really feel that what Creator wants me to do. So I asked, so I smudged and, you know, and I prayed about it, and I offered some tobacco, and I ask, you know, I do these things, you know, and I don't like to talk about them because I think it's real personal. But I'll share with you. But I do these things, you know, and here's some of the medicines I never used before. Like I said, I always abuse these things. But, you know, I believe today that, that help's available when we're ready for it. Help is always around us. And I believe our ancestors are around us. They're around us, always willing to help when we're ready. When a student is ready, a teacher always appears. And a lot of times that teacher is in the unseen world. We can't see him physically, but he's there. And so I believe that, that I'm going through this, but I'm not alone. And I know that I got physical, not only physical help, but I got help from the unseen world too. And so I'm dealing with this, and it's painful. And I hurt a lot. And I got a lot of questions. And I'm going to happen to learn to be patient with this, with myself. I pray every day to be patient. I pray every day to be, to love myself, to care enough for myself, to take care of myself and to take care of my, these personal needs and these issues. And the strength not to give up. And so I hope this helps someone else, you know. So I've been asked before, I'm going to wrap this up. I've been asked before, I think about some of the time I lost, you know, and I've been asked that before, you know, you feel bad you lost all this time, you know, and be honest, you know, yes and no. Yes, part of me, I feel bad about losing it because I would have had maybe 35 years. But part of me say I wouldn't know what I know now. I didn't know what I know now, share with other people. And I really feel, I like working with someone that's been in long-term recovery who was hurting or maybe have relapsed. And I'll help anybody. It doesn't matter who they are, but, you know, but I really feel drawn toward other people that who maybe relapsed and had some years behind them because I know how it is. But I believe in the loving Creator who loves us, that takes us, reaches inside and cleans out the wounds and bandages us back up and starts putting us back together. And I don't know if it's going to be something I do for the rest of my life. It probably is. But I wouldn't change anything. I don't want anybody to take my pain away because I want to know what it is, why I have it, and how I can help others. And I thank you for allowing me to speak. Karen, and I love you guys, and I hope that it's helped someone. You know, it's definitely helped me tonight, you know.
I appreciate you coming on and talking.
Thank you.
You have a great evening, and I hope someone does take something from you speaking tonight, and I really appreciate you coming on. I hope you have a great rest of the evening. And I want to wish that for everyone else as well. And I guess we will conclude the show. Everybody have a great night, and thank you once again.
Thank you.
You're welcome.